Now, you have a record of the proceedings from the last week, and they're there for information. If you have any questions about them, you can talk to Leo. What we are now going to do is Marilyn Jacobson, Director of Communications, is going to talk about public hearings and our communication strategy. Very soon, we're going to be in 49 public hearings throughout the province. This is a very, very important stage of what we're doing as the Citizens' Assembly. And it's terribly important, of course, that we have a strategy and that these hearings are as effective as they can be. So it's my pleasure then to turn this over to Marilyn.
Many of you have been asking about the communication strategy for the public hearings, so we thought I'd give you a quick overview of our plans. I'm going to try to keep it quite high level because I don't want to cut into Elizabeth's time. At the end, if you have some questions, hopefully we'll have time for one or two questions. If we don't get around to your question, feel free to talk to Dawn or me anytime during the weekend or email us during the week or phone us. We have several objectives. Our ongoing objective, obviously, is awareness. But we also, at this stage, want to encourage attendance at the public hearings, as well as encourage participation in the public hearings, as well as try to get people to make submissions and presentations. We really need to hear from British Columbians at this stage of our process. Our strategies are fourfold. The first involves you, the members of the Assembly. Second, we will continue to communicate with people through our established assembly media, our newsletter, and our website. And third, we're going to continue and even ramp up our attempts to get media to cover the assembly. And finally, we're going to be advertising the public hearings themselves. So just to talk a little bit more about that, this is how we plan to implement those strategies. First, as I said, we're counting on you, the 160 members of the Assembly, to actively promote the Assembly and the upcoming hearings in your communities. For example, you can contact your local community associations and schools and see if they would like you to come speak to their groups or to their classes. You can encourage your friends and your neighbors to come to hearings, even encourage them to register to present at hearings. You can contact your local media, offer to do an interview or perhaps write an article. You can contact your friends and, you know, just get people excited about the process. So to help you with this task, we have put together a number of tools. I'm calling it a toolkit. We still have a few more tools to go into that kit, but those of you that have been on your members' website in the last few days have seen that we've actually posted some of those tools to the members' website already. And next weekend we'll be providing you with a package, paper copies of all these various tools. Second, as I said, we're going to continue to leverage our established assembly media, our website, and our newsletter. We currently have 1,400 people on our newsletter distribution list. And these are people who are motivated. I mean, they're interested in the work of the assembly. They're interested in electoral reform. So they're a target audience for us in terms of getting people to come to hearings and to present. Our website is also proving very effective. Don was just reminding me that the website's only been in operation since near the end of November. And we've already had 10,000 unique visitors on that website, an average of over 200 every day. And each visitor is spending some time on the website. They're looking at an average of 6 pages. Since the audio and video recordings of these plenary sessions went up just a couple weeks ago, we've had 600 downloads of these files. So our website is proving to be a very effective tool, and Don's done a great job on that. We also have over 100 submissions posted on the website, and we're going to make sure that these people who have posted submissions, as well as other potential presenters, are aware of the opportunity to present at public hearings. As I said, Don and I will be ramping up our media work. Our regular news releases go to over 800 key media people throughout the province. And in addition to those regular releases, with the public hearings coming up, we're going to be preparing customized news releases for every community that has a public hearing. And we're going to be looking to you to help us with those customized releases as well. We'll probably be contacting a number of you asking for some quotes and different things that will help us really engage the media in that community. We're also going to be setting up interviews with the local media as we go from public hearing community to public hearing community. In addition, we will work to get the public hearings listed on community calendars that are offered on television, cable, radio, and newspapers. And this is a task you can help with as well. If you're aware of a newspaper or a cable station that has a community calendar, feel free to contact them and let them know about the hearings in your community. And finally, we've identified about 150 newspapers in BC in which we'll be placing notices of the public hearings in those communities. I just want to talk a little bit more about the members' toolkit that we are preparing for you. It includes a PowerPoint presentation complete with talk notes. And Wendy test drove that for us this week, and I understand it went reasonably well. In addition, we're working on a series of fact sheets. These are drawn from Ken and Campbell's lectures over the past few weeks. And these you can use as handouts. We have a number of other handouts as well. And Susanna's working on preparing materials that you can use to contact schools, speak to students, and leave with teachers to help them stay engaged with the assembly and our work. And finally, in April sometime, we hope to have a video that you will be able to use when you are out speaking. Now, this is an ambitious communications program. It's certainly going to keep us busy in the office. And I know many of you are chomping at the bit to get started, and some of you have already started. So we will try to get that toolkit to you as soon as possible. Others of you may be feeling a bit intimidated right now, but I encourage you to give it a try. You'll find that what you have to say is of interest to a lot of British Columbians. Very few British Columbians have the expertise that you now have, and I think it'd be great if you would share that with the people in your community. And it's not just the facts that your fellow citizens are interested in hearing about from you. They're also interested in hearing about your experience in the Assembly, because this is a very unique process. It's a new way of tackling public policy making, and I think a lot of British Columbians would be keen to hear about that from you. Do we have time for a few questions? Do you have any questions? Bill?
I noticed you mentioned that you were having some 150 posters made.
We've identified 150 newspapers that we'll be putting ads in.
Would you actually be making posters that we could actually post in our communities?
We could do that. We could turn the ads into posters if the members want to have that to provide around your communities.
Why not?
One more. Rob?
In my community, there isn't an actual meeting, but there is meetings around it. Are you still going to be advertising in the community there?
Yes, we will. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. And as Marilyn has indicated, by the way, get in touch with Marilyn or Don at any time. They are very, very accessible people. And both during the weekend and during the week, phone them, email them, or whatever. And now my pleasure to... Leo's got a few remarks to make.
Just one thing came up this morning. Some of you did not include your local communities on your selection. And I just assume that the date and your availability conflicted because, and so we carried on with that assumption and assigned you elsewhere with the choices you had made. Some people say they really want to get to their local community. So if that's the case, then do let me know and we'll do some swapping around because I've tried to limit it to three meetings per at the maximum side, I think, because lots of people want to go to meetings and a fair number of people only have two, so I'll do some swapping. If there are some of you who really want to get to your local meeting and that hasn't been identified as one of your communities. The other thing, I need to try to reduce the size of one of the Vancouver meetings. I've got 19 in one and 15 in the other. And so I have three names that I'd like to, if one of you will move, because I've already got a volunteer, but Ann Rushlow or Craig Peterson. If either one of you would feel comfortable going over to the Vancouver meeting at the beginning of May rather than the one that was scheduled at the end of May, if you could let me know. Thank you.
Professor Ken Carty.
Okay, It's a great pleasure to welcome this afternoon to the Citizens Assembly Elizabeth McClay from the Victoria University in Wellington. That's the university in the national capital of New Zealand. Elizabeth's a graduate of the University of Auckland. Auckland's the largest city in the country, so she knows both of them well. She was, a few years ago, a Rhodes Fellow at Oxford. She was one of the women who helped prove to the Rhodes Trust that Rhodes scholarships could go to women as well as men. And so she was a pioneer in that long-for development. She's really an expert on parliamentary government and cabinet government in the Westminster systems, and is engaged in now a partnership in a large comparative project on parliamentary governments. But in recent years has been part of a team, a remarkable team of political scientists in New Zealand called the New Zealand Political Change Project. And they saw about 10 years ago that something big was happening in New Zealand. They were going to change the system. And they said, well, we really ought to pay a lot of attention to this. We ought to chart it. We ought to see how it affects elections and political parties, but also how it affects the parliament and the government and the way that the legislature works. And so she's been at the center of this decade-long investigation. It's produced really a remarkable body of work. Recent books include The Cabinet in Power in New Zealand, New Zealand Under MMP, A New Politics, and very recently a new book called New Zealand Votes, The General Election of 2000. So she brings enormous expertise. I can also tell you she's a wonderful teacher. How many of you have had Hillary at one point or another as a facilitator and know how good she is? Well, one of the small reasons she's as good as she is because Elizabeth was her first professor at Victoria University. So if she was that good for Hillary, she'll, I'm sure, be that good or better for us. Not to put you down, Hillary. How great you are is one of the reasons we are so glad to have Elizabeth. Anyway, it's my great pleasure to introduce Elizabeth McClay.
One of the things about this world is nearly everyone else is taller than I am. Oh, are they mean?
And all the truth.
Well, thank you very much, Jack, for inviting me, Ken, Campbell, and his wonderful team of assistants, who all of whom have been so hospitable. I thank you also for to the facilitators, and to one young man in particular, and he knows who I mean. Thanks also to everyone for being such interested citizens. That political scientists love anyone who will listen to us speak, of course. And if they're really interested, that makes it even better. It is indeed a privilege to be here. It is, as David said earlier, a unique, I was going to say experiment, but I don't want to use that word. It's a unique occasion for citizens to come together in this way. And I'll tell you one thing. My political science colleagues in Victoria are green with envy that I'm here and they're not. Thank you. Okay, so I want to tell a story of electoral system change. I want to tell it like a story because it is a fascinating series of events. One of the really good things about New Zealand adopting MMP is it's suddenly become an interesting story. I've gone around saying that one good thing about MMP was that it's rescued New Zealand from being just a little wee footnote in learned papers. Now it's a bit more than that. But of course we're very small. We're an appropriate example for you to look at. Our population is about the same. We have a population of 4 million people. We're a primary producing country. We have an indigenous people, the Māori, who at the moment make up about 15% of the population, which is a bit different from here, but we're both settler societies, settlers of all different peoples. We both have Westminster-influenced parliamentary systems. There are our parliamentary buildings, and I think it's a wonderful way of illustrating the fact that in a Westminster system, cabinet sits alongside and in Parliament, because that funny-looking round building, which all New Zealanders call the Beehive, houses the executive, and Cabinet sits on the top floor of that, whereas the MPs sit in the
in the house next door. We abolished our upper house in 1950, which is really part of the whole story. But so there is only one chamber now. And if we flick and play around with wonderful modern technology and flick through to this website way on the other side of the world, come down a bit, there we have our cabinet. A group of people sitting around an oval table and turning around with her face towards us is the present Prime Minister, Helen Clark, who, former political scientist, leads a minority government. They don't have a majority of seats in the House. It's a Labour Progressive Coalition government. But the Progressive Coalition have only two MPs in the whole House. And so there's only one of those MPs in the cabinet itself. Okay, so there are a lot of similarities between the two states. We have similar kinds of political systems, similar kinds of societies. There are important differences because we are, of course, in New Zealand, a national state. We're not a province, even though we're small and relatively unimportant. Now, my story is in four parts. I want, first of all, to say just a little bit about, let's try this again, a little bit about the pathway to change, because I've had so many questions about that. A little bit about the background. If you want to know more, and I won't advertise my books in this case, there you can go to the background notes, because I put quite a lot of material in the background notes for you to read at your leisure. The second thing I want to move on to is the nature of the new system, the rules themselves. Third, I want to look at really the primary focus, the reason why I was asked here, the impact of the new system. And fourth, make some concluding remarks. So let's turn now to the reasons for the changes. And David has very accurately, of course, identified these earlier. But very quickly, there was the view that the minor parties were unfairly treated. They were particularly unfairly treated in New Zealand just because the way their votes were spread across the country. And as we all know, in a single-member constituency system, it makes it difficult for them to get into Parliament when that happens. Then we had something that's happened here. 1978 and 1981, National won the most seats while Labour won the most votes. And that always is a sore point for political players. And third, and this is very important, voters felt that governments were unaccountable to them. They were, particularly since both the governments of Labour and National went for very radical policy changes, some of which were approved of by the voters, but many of which were felt to be unsuitable and anyway to have just been enacted far too quickly. So there was an environment, a readiness for change amongst the New Zealand people. So Labour decided to appoint a Royal Commission. Now, Royal Commissions can be a way of not dealing with things for governments. And I think when the Labour government found the results of the Royal Commission, they thought, yes, we will put this one aside, a bit like the Jenkins Commission results. Now, but the commission itself had no politicians on it. It was a small group, and it took hearings. They travelled throughout the world, and it took hearings, and it had many, many submissions to it. So there was public input into it and no political control on its content. And indeed, its agenda was very wide. It was permitted also to look at things like the financing of parties and also whether we should have a new upper house. So it had a very wide agenda. Now, the criteria that it developed, that it wished, on which it evaluated different sorts of electoral systems, appears in your background notes. So sometime you might like to have a look at those, but I won't go through them here. Now, there was a whole series of accidents, which explains how we got to have public input in the form of referendums. That's a whole other story. But let us just say here that we had the opportunity to have two bites at the cherry. The 1992 election was an election promise by the then National Well, the National Party that came into power is a single-party majority government in 1990. And whoops, it got into power. Whoops, it better do something about a referendum, since Labour had promised one and hadn't got round to doing it. So we had the old adversarial politics being played about electoral rules. So it said, yeah, okay, we'll have a referendum. And some of us think they thought, well, we'll make it as difficult as possible for the people, because we actually had a choice of five systems. Try explaining five different systems. Yep, you get the picture. However, overwhelmingly, that referendum, the voters chose to reject the existing system, which, of course, is the same as the one here, and to go for the mixed-member proportional system. But that referendum was only an advisory on government. Government didn't have to take notice of it. So then it had said, well, it will have another referendum in 1993, which was the date for the next election. And so we had a second election, this time between the two, between the existing system and the proposed new system recommended by the Royal Commission, MMP, Mixed Member Proportional. And the MMP came top, not by a huge majority, but by a decent majority over FPP, I mean a respectably democratic majority. Now, I'd like to just say, because I know there's a lot of interest in the whole public education process, what the government did was to find a neutral, respected person, an ombudsman, actually, to head up a public education program. So both in 1992 and 1993, there was a public education program. Everything from community meetings, the unions, women's groups, schools, and so forth, would ask for speakers, and speakers would be sent to them, through to advertising on radio, in the newspapers, and on television about the electoral systems. Of course, it was much easier for 1993 than 1992, because easier to discuss two than five. So that was accompanied by an educational process. And just to continue on that in that vein, before every election, there's been another process. In fact, our electoral commission is continually monitoring people's knowledge of the system and sending out information packets, trying to educate people about how the rules work. So I just mentioned that because of the interest in it. The legislation was formed on the basis of the 1993 Electoral Act, and that is the first time the politicians got a go at it. And of course they made changes. Of course, they, as self-interested people, they made some changes to the legislation. They didn't quite dare to mess around with it too dramatically, but they did make one very important thing change. The Royal Commission recommended that there be a threshold, a legal threshold of 4%. The Parliament made it 5%, and I don't need to explain to you experts why. That period was also very interesting, though. That period of our last Parliament under the old rules, because during that time, Parliament actually, in a very interesting way, looked forward to the future, thought, what is it going to be like running a Parliament that has many parties rather than just two dominant parties? So it sent a little contingent of MPs and officials round about five European systems, and it was very innovatory. It said, well, okay, we have to run the business of the House differently. So there is now a business committee chaired by the Speaker, which makes the whole arrangement of time, who gets speaking rights, what happens to committee reports and so forth, makes that whole business much more transparent. Yes, governments still have the whip hand, but it is an improvement. It's interesting that minor parties make sure that they're there. And there were other changes. We already had, potentially, a very influential committee system. It was made more influential by making all the committees had to be overall, in the future, they had to reflect the overall proportionality of parties in the House. They didn't do everything at the stage. They didn't say that the party chairs
have to be proportionate. But that is creeping in. At first, governments continue to dominate the chairs, although the chairs are less influential than they used to be because they don't have casting votes. So, yes, that period was a period of change and preparation and planning, but it was also a period of upheaval when MPs looked at the new rules and thought, heavens, I mightn't get an electorate next time. I mightn't get a constituency. I better rush off and join another party. I might get on someone's list, or I might head up a party. And so there was a period of the biggest upheaval within the parliament we've ever had, with new parties being created during that time. Basically, the same government proceeded in power, but with a lot, the dynamics were quite different. So in a way, it was like a little bit of a dress rehearsal for proportionally elected parliaments. And in 1996, we had our first MMP election. We have had two MMP elections since 1999 and 2002. Or one more instance of the kind of changes that had to go on before the first election was come from the parties themselves and from the public service. Because the public service, so used to dealing with a government that could probably implement what it said it wanted to do and what the public service said it should do. Suddenly, there were going to be more players in the negotiation game. And so the public service also prepared itself, as did the parties. The parties had to develop new methods of selecting their candidates. Okay, they knew how to select their constituency MPs, but they didn't know how to construct party lists. Some of them still don't do it very well. However, so there was a lot of learning that had to be done even before the first election. And I was lucky enough to be part of this team that was following the story. One other point, the 1993 Electoral Act required that the Parliament itself review the workings of the new rules and report back before the middle of 2002. It constructed a cross-party committee that I had the privilege of following in terms of its deliberations. It was constructed on consensual grounds. In other words, if more than one party objected to anything, there was going to be no change. And guess what? There were no changes. So although, in my view, the MMP system as we have it needs tweaking in various directions, nothing has happened so far. Now, let us move on to the system itself, and forgive me if I go through rather quickly, because otherwise I'm never going to get on to the effects. Very quickly, the proportions between the constituency MPs and the list MPs changes for a number of reasons, which I won't go into. But in the 2002 election, there were 69 constituency MPs, and they included 7 Māori seats and 51 list MPs. We have a nationwide party list, no regional lists, nationwide, and it's a closed system. New Zealanders cannot change the order of the candidates on the list. They have to accept the order that decided on by the parties. To go back to the Māori seats, New Zealand between 1867 and the end of the FPP era had 4 Māori seats. But for many years now, Māori could choose whether to enrol and vote on a Māori seat or enrol and vote on a constituency seat. Some would choose one way, someone would choose another way. The 1993 legislation determined that the number of Māori seats in future would either go up or down according to how many Māori actually registered on the Māori register. So if they decide they don't want them any longer, they stop enrolling. It's an entirely voluntary system, but the constituencies work like, well, if you imagine a couple of transparencies, okay, you've got a transparency of New Zealand here with all the single-member constituency, this is the general seats, and then you have a transparency on top of it with the seven Māori constituencies. And so if you are Māori and you enrol on the Māori seat, you will make your party vote in the normal way, but you will vote in your Māori constituency for your Māori representative. If you are on a general seat, you just vote in a general seat and have your party vote in the same way. Electors have two votes for the preferred party list and for the choice of constituency MP. And if we go in here, we should see a ballot paper. It's lovely that everything's working so well today. Thanks to the technical advice. This is the kind of advertising, not sure that it's very clear, but if you have an access to a computer, of course, you can check these sites yourself at home or elsewhere. I think somewhere down here it is. Oh, yes, sorry, went right past it. You're presented when you go into the booth with this one party saying you have two votes. The party vote on the left and the electorate, we call them electorates in New Zealand, on the right. And it says vote for only one party, and you've got carrots, peaches, squash, banana, broccoli, etc. And on the other hand, you have some names. And you will note that the names for the electorate vote are in alphabetical order. So Mr. Allenby, Mr. Fred Allenby is a carrot, and so the party vote for Carrot is put side his name. But it's not a complicated ballot paper, because all you have to do is tick your choice of vote. You tick for Carrot, and you might tick for Mr. Allenby. On the other hand, you might think that someone down here, McMadsen, isn't it, might be a better local representative. Okay? In order to be awarded, where was I up to? Yes, the number of parliamentary seats is very important. There's 120, very controversial. You see, by the time we finished having first past the post, SNP, we had 99 MPs, and there was a lot of resentment about the increased number of MPs. And indeed, it's been the subject since then of an indicative referendum. A referendum was taken to the polls in 1999, and most people said there were too many MPs. I think there are very strong reasons for not having a small house. Not the least is whether you want proportionality, but also whether you can actually have an effective committee system in a small house. But nevertheless, it's been highly controversial in New Zealand, and many people felt that people would vote against having a new system on the grounds that it was just too jolly many MPs living off the public purse. I disagree, but there we are. Now, I have mentioned already, I think, that there is a threshold of 5%. That's getting 5% of the nationwide party vote, or alternatively, if parties win just one of the constituencies, then they're awarded seats in proportion to their shares of the party vote. So it's an alternative threshold, and we'll have an example of that when we discuss the 2002 election. A candidate may stand for both a constituency and a party list, and indeed at least one of the parties requires all its people to stand for both lists. And as I've already explained, the position of Māori MPs, and we'll skip through that. The electoral formula is used, is mentioned here. If you go again into the New Zealand election website, you can play games with that formula, because you can do a mock exercise in an election and see how that formula works out in the distribution of votes. But the important point is that it is a proportional system, so that, first of all, the number of constituency seats each party gets is counted up, or if an independent, which hasn't happened, got a seat, it would be counted up. And then the rest of the seats are distributed to the parties in proportion to their share of the nationwide vote. So it is a complementary system, and it's a proportional system. Constituency seat vacancies filled by by-election, while list seat vacancies are filled from the party list. The impact of MMP, my third topic. Are we still awake? Good. Okay, I want to look at the political institutions on one side, but I also want to look at the citizens. And as you know, there's a common nickname for citizens. That's the great spotted. And here's a smaller brown kiwi. Okay. Let's look first at Parliament. What difference did electoral system change make to the composition of Parliament, taking parties first? Yes, certainly, we moved from being a dominantly two-party Parliament to a multi-party Parliament. The Labour Party and on the centre-left and the National Party on the centre-right had dominated voting and seats in the House from 1935 until electoral system change. It was either one party or the other. And there were very few minor parties ever elected. Occasionally we got a couple. Okay, what has happened in terms of threshold? Well, it has certainly excluded the minor parties. The unluckiest party was in 1996, because it got 4.3% of the party vote, but didn't win any constituencies. And, of course, if it had won one constituency, it would have got 4.3%, roughly, of the seats in Parliament. Compare that with New Zealand First, which in 1999 did not reach the 5% threshold, but still brought into the House, I think, 5 MPs. So if you get 5% of the House, you get 6 MPs. But if five with the reason why New Zealand First got in was that Winston Peters, a marvellously populist election of Maori background and great personality, had been held a constituency who's very fond of him for a number of years under the previous system. So, of course, he held on to that constituency, and that allowed him to survive in 1999, even though that party, his party, New Zealand First, did not reach the threshold. The Progressive Coalition in 2002, I think I mentioned at the very beginning, just brought in 2 MPs, and that was because Jim Anderton, that leader, had a seat under FPP, which, with a lot of loyal followers also. He, incidentally, is on the left of the political spectrum. This might help you. This gives you an idea of just one election, the most recent one, because the most recent ones are always most interesting. And these are the parties that crossed the threshold. And so what we give you here is the one line with the percentage of party votes, the number of C for constituency seats, number of L for list seats, and the percentage of seats in the House itself. Just a quick mapping of the policy positions of the parties, so that they're not just names on a flashed up on a screen. I've put them, to be fair, no, they're not quite in alphabetical order. Oh, well. ACT is on, generally speaking, on the right in terms that it's a neo-liberal economic party, you know, reduce the amount of states, reduce taxation kind of party, quite liberal on moral issues. The Greens are a green party which are on the left on most issues. Progressive Coalition was part of another party which collapsed called the Alliance, and its centre, its left, but not as far left as the Greens. Labour is centre-left, and as you know, Labour and Progressive Coalition formed a government. National is the centre-right party, which did extremely badly in that election. And New Zealand First is a middle-ground party. It's a party led by Winston Peters, scraped in 1999. And United Future had one member in one constituency for 1996 and 1999, and the leader, stood up in last election and talked about being reasonable and suddenly came to 6.7%. So, an interesting story. And the United Future, to fill in the picture a little bit more, has a coalition agreement with the minority coalition government. It's been pretty stable because, of course, Labour and the Progressive Coalition don't have enough votes between them to keep the confidence of the House or pass a budget. So United Future votes with the government, has agreed to vote with the government on those issues, and I don't think will change, because it believes that if you're in a centre party position and you go into a coalition, your duty is to keep the country stable. Believes in effective government, for those of you who are sitting in the middle session earlier today. But the government also has an agreement with Greens, because the United Future is rather more right-wing on some issues than the government is. So on some issues, the Greens support the government. And for example, they negotiated together to have a new transport policy. So I think that fills in the 2002 election, also gives you an idea of how the system works in practice. So just to sum up some of those points, very quickly, these are the parties that did not get the 5% threshold and did not either, of course, win one seat. So MMP has delivered a much more party proportionate parliament than under FPP. That is a clear finding. It was anticipated by everyone. The thresholds have affected parliamentary composition. They've certainly influenced the number of parties in the House. The traditional parties, Labour and National, you might have noticed, are predominantly constituency parties. Most of their people are elected through the constituencies. And I think if you are going through electoral system change, you have to expect that, because, of course, that's where their heartlands historically have been. The newer parties are predominantly list parties, although several have a leader who occupy a single person constituency, and that acts as a kind of safety net for those parties, for better or worse. There have been other issues arising, though, and the questions we often ask, and you have been asking, is does a proportional system lead to party fragmentation, to defections? What's discipline like in the House? Well, to New Zealanders' horror, three parliaments, 1993, 1996, but we really have to remove that one in our minds in some ways, because that was the run-up parliament, the transitional parliament. Three parliaments, but the next one too, experienced the splitting of parties in between elections. In brief, the main reason for that was that those parties that went into coalition with the big party found their bedfellow a little bit uncomfortable. Too much snoring, elbowing, I don't know what. But more joking aside, it's a real problem for a minor party going into coalition with a major party, because you go in saying, well, it's important to keep the government together, to support the government, to be stable, to have collective responsibility for actions. On the other hand, the closer it gets to election time, the more that party thinks, well, I'd like my policies to be noticed because I want to get re-elected. So the minor parties in New Zealand have had some learning to do about just how you do that. And now the coalition agreements allow for that. They allow a measure of independence for the minor parties over not over every issue, but over some issues, to allow for minor parties being able to go to the electorate election time and say, well, we are responsible for some things. We have had an impact on policy. So what had happened was that New Zealand first split in 1998. It was in coalition with National, and it just split under the tension of all sorts of things. Not only the reason I've just given, but also it had internal problems of policy issues. Many of those people who were in the New Zealand First Party were really more naturally allied with the Labour Party. And many of their supporters thought that they were going to go into coalition with Labour in 1996 and were deeply disappointed. So there was a lot of learning going on, and the behaviour of some of those MPs and the behaviour of New Zealand First not declaring its preferences to the public about clearly and then really going against its expressed views in the coalition negotiations was bad for the party and was very bad for the new electoral system. And the question is, we ask, whether these were simply the teething problems of an unfamiliar electoral system. If you look at Germany, it had a lot of problems in the earlier days of people leaving their parties and so forth. And that, after a while, stopped. In general, however, the parliamentary parties remain disciplined. I mean, I've been stressing that several parties split. The Greens were part of an alliance of parties. They split off after 1996 to fight the 1999 election on its own, and it worked out for them. But in general, the parties are disciplined. The Labour, National, ACT, the Greens, New Zealand First Now, they are all actors, the kind of disciplined political parties we remember. Or we recognise, perhaps I should say. Okay, now look at another effect of MMP, and that is that the parliaments are more representative of groups and opinions than under FPP, and it's those groups that I want to concentrate on now. And in general, the increased representativeness is a consequence of parties having to create balanced party lists. A quick sketch through quick look through history. Women in 1945, women MPs, 2.5%. 1993, under FPP, 21%, but very high for a single-member plurality system at that time. 1996, 29%, the first MMP election, 29%, 31% in 1999, gone down slightly in 2002, unfortunately. As for Māori, well, they were 5% in 1945, 6% in 1993, 13.3% in 1996, and about the same in 1999, and higher in 2002. Pacific Island, from no representation through to much more. If we see it in a more interesting way, a graph rather than just figures, we see the climb after 1996 of all those previously underrepresented or unrepresented groups. I should say on that to give you an idea of the social composition of the country, I think I said Māori are about 15% of the country, those who identify as being Māori. I mean, we're all intermarried, but it's a matter of how one identifies. Of Pacific peoples, about 7%, and these are from the islands, the Cooks, the Fijian islands, Samoa, Niue, Tokelau, and so forth. And we now have about 7% of Asian peoples. I know Asian is a pretty crude term and doesn't really pick up the dynamics of the different groups who've come to New Zealand ever since the 19th century and the gold rushes, really. But we have now people from the subcontinent of India, from China, from all around the Asian region. And you can see that now we have a tiny percentage, not enough, but a tiny percentage of those groups in Parliament now also. I said in an earlier slide that mostly people got there because of the party lists, that the parties felt that they had to balance the lists socially. And you can see here that, and this was an expected consequence of MMP, you can see here that the purple blocks are the lists, and that as far as women are concerned, in 1996, certainly having party lists promoted women. Certainly in 1999, but whoops, what happens in 2002? Well, it's an interesting story, but it's mainly because Labour won many constituency seats in 2002, and Labour had actually been nominating women for their single-member constituencies. And so, of course, women did very well through the constituencies because Labour got so many constituency seats. On the other hand, New Zealand First and United Future nominated very few women indeed for their party lists. And I must say, they both did unexpectedly well in 2002. So they're, you know, dominated by the suits and their caucuses. But there's been a lot of criticism of that, and I expect them to work a little bit harder in the future about nominating women. I'm certainly showing my feminist colours here. On the other hand, they now have incumbents who are male, so it'll be difficult even if they want to appoint more women. So composing those lists is very important. Incidentally, we do not have quotas in New Zealand, and never had, except for one party, the Greens. Similarly, I have said that we have the strange system of Māori representation, but as you can see here, the Māori electorate seats are in yellow, that more Māori are coming through the party lists than in the Māori electorates, which is, I think, great for our democracy. And, of course, we also have several MPs who elected from the general constituency seats, not the Māori constituency seats. Okay, what about those Kiwi I showed you earlier? I think the first observation I'd like to make is that MPs, voters, the media have all taken a while to adjust to having two types of MPs. I think this is one of the biggest adjustments that has had to be made. List MPs, I say are, but perhaps decreasingly so, were widely regarded as less hardworking and less accountable than constituency MPs. On that second bullet point, just a few more observations. There were reports of turf battles, you know, constituency MPs not liking a list MP setting up a constituency office. But this seems to be dying down. The list MPs increasingly are going for regional offices rather than constituency offices, for doing work for the people, but being rather more careful about how they challenge the local empires of the constituency MPs. I think that we could have dealt with this much better in New Zealand. I think what we should have done is what the Scots did and have a code of conduct about how to deal with constituency issues. Often electoral rules aren't enough on their own. We need other kinds of guidance for people, and something like a code of conduct and perhaps even job descriptions would have helped. It would have helped the new list MPs who, after all, came in to learn something, a role that no one knew about. It would have helped the list MPs. It would have helped constituency MPs. Incidentally, the list MPs' constituency allowances are not as good as the allowances for the constituency MPs. So, sorry, the list MPs' allowances aren't as big, did I say that, as the constituency MPs. So this has all acted as a disincentive for list MPs, and decreasingly they are doing that constituency work. The Royal Commission actually saw the whole issue the other way around. It said, look, it's a great thing if list MPs set up constituency offices. If you don't want to go to the Carrot Party for help with your problem, just because the Carrot Party MP is in your electorate MP, you can go to the Swede or the Potato Party instead, who might be more helpful. So you can look, as with electoral rules, at this whole issue in more ways than one. And I think also it was a problem to adjust for New Zealand. After all, we'd had 100 years or so of a particular kind of electoral system with a particular kind of MP and very, very strong links in New Zealand between those constituency MPs and their electorates and their constituents. The MPs have always had surgeries every weekend where people could call in and talk about their problems. So the tradition was very strong in one direction. But I move on to the other point I make about this, and that's a third bullet point. And this is an ongoing problem. Because there are fewer electorates than there used to be, they're larger. And this affects rural areas particularly, because the electorates have become bigger. And it also affects their MPs, who have to do a lot of driving to get round their constituents. And it's a long way sometimes for constituents to talk to MPs. Some people think that in this modern age that e-parliament, e-communications will help, and certainly the New Zealand Parliament and the parties are moving in this direction to try to cure that difficulty. But this is a real problem, the size of rural electorates. And it's a reason for not having, if anyone has a mixed member system, to not to have too few MPs, because of course then you end up with constituencies that are just too big. Sorry? Yeah. Okay. Our constituency MPs, just take up the third point, have become safer under MMP, with the marginal list seats the most precarious. People have enjoyed voting their two votes, and they like to support their local MP. They commonly split that ballot paper, voting for an MP of one party and then for a party of a different flavour. Parliament has certainly, and I've touched on this with my introductory remarks, has become much more important, partly because we've had minority governments, and governments simply have had to consult in order to pass legislation. Parliament is much more assertive. The committee system is much stronger. Legislation is changed all the time by committees. There has to be negotiation. The opposition parties are drawn into the policy process very much more. However, politics is no less aggressive. It's still a battle. Politics is about conflict. We're never going to get rid of that. However, negotiation, particularly in committees, has become part of the fabric of parliamentary life. Consultation between ministers of different parties, between ministers and their support parties, between ministers and their own backbenchers, is essential. Because we have had only one majority coalition government, the rest have been minority governments, we have had this particular pattern. But even with a majority coalition government, you have to have negotiation, because there has to be negotiation between the two major parties. Radical policy making of the nature we used to have has gone out the window, although there has been a difference between the earlier coalitions of the centre-right and the present coalition of the centre-left. I have dealt with all these problems, so forgive me if I switch on. The negotiations between parties forming governments are held in secret, but there has been an increased tendency for parties to declare who they wish to form alliances with after an election, to declare that to the public, learning from the experience in 1996. And they make coalition agreements, they work out their rules, they allocate the cabinet posts together and select ministers. And I then move on to a slide of the unanticipated consequences, but as always I'm inclined to jump all around the place when I give a presentation. I've mentioned most of these, the fragmentation. Perhaps we didn't get as many different sorts of parties as we did before. Problem of the list MP's legitimacy. Some hostility to perceived Māori power. Some parties very slow to learn the new campaigning. The National Party completely failed to campaign for the party vote at the last election. Disappointing continuing decline in party membership, down to only about 2.4% in the whole population. Continued adversarialism, these are some of the bad bits. The business of 1996 I mentioned. Less impact is a good thing on the public sector than expected. The voters have been highly strategic voters. They've split their votes, about one-third, over a third split their votes. Voters dislike dual candidacies, but there's been a decreasing number of people losing on their electorates and getting in, overall, getting in on the party list vote. Some voters, not all, distrust party list MPs, regarding them as unaccountable. Significant role placed by the one-seat alternative threshold. I think this is a distortion of the system personally. I think it makes some people's votes worth more than others, and I would like to see it go. And there's the whole problem of the size of the House that I mentioned earlier. So in short, it's dangerous to underestimate the strength of old political traditions. It takes time. One has to allow for time to learn, both for political parties and also to allow that for the fact that mostly the political actors will try to change the rules, whatever you set up. And finally, Jack, finally, you'll be really glad to know, looking very restive here, the lessons to be learned. Don't expect electoral system reform to cure all or even most of the political system's problems. I think New Zealanders have learned that. Make sure that the expectations are realistic. Unfortunately, before 1993, people went around saying that, you know, we'd have this wonderful consensual policy, that all the backbiting and the fighting would disappear. So people were disappointed when it didn't disappear. Two, give the new rules time to settle down. I mean, one important political scientist says an electoral system takes at least 3 parliamentary terms before you really understand it and know it. Third, and I think the New Zealand experience is very important here, is that the early years are important when establishing the legitimacy of a new electoral system, and that politicians' behaviour is important at this time. If they behave badly, as happened in New Zealand, people blame the system. It's not reasonable, but it's understandable. And fourth, it is perhaps difficult, perhaps impossible, to predict all the effects of any electoral system change. Thank you for your attention. I'm happy to receive a few questions.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was a great story, well told, very helpful to us. We have a few minutes for questions, but remember, we do have later on this evening, we have a chance to talk to both Elizabeth and David. Derek, you're first.
Hi. My question is whether, given concerns you've raised about the list members, has there been any outcry or any consideration of the open list system, and if not, why not?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last bit.
Has there been consideration of an open list system as opposed to a closed party list system? And if not, why not? If so, why so?
At the MMP review conducted by Parliament that I mentioned earlier, there were submissions advocating an open list system. Unfortunately, the politicians did not agree. Some of the parties agreed, but not all of them. So there has been some consideration, and a lot of people would like to see that happen. It might happen in the future, perhaps. Thank you.
Jill.
I'm over here. Sorry.
Yeah.
You mentioned concern about the size of the parliament with an MMP system, that there has to be enough seats for it to really affect proportionality, and that in New Zealand you increased the size of your house from 99 to 120, you wanted more. Mm. We have a mandate that we can't really move beyond 79 seats. Is that, in your view, going to sort of make MMP not a realistic alternative here?
Well, I think I'm going to be very careful here and say that there are many types of mixed member systems, and that New Zealand, the German model, is only one. And if you were interested in adopting a mixed member system, you might find one that was more appropriate for a smaller house. So the idea is to think very carefully about how you would want to balance the different ingredients. Certainly some proportionality could be achieved. Yeah.
Thank you. Jim?
My question is to you. Come over here.
Thank you.
On this new system that was introduced into New Zealand, did the voters turn out more or less?
I jotted down the figures. I'm rotten at remembering figures. Back in the 1980s, we had over 90% occasionally turnout, and we do not have compulsory voting. In 1993, that's before MMP, we had 85.2%. 1996, the first election, it went up 88.3%. It went down, though, in 1999, and I think there was disillusionment with the new system, and that went to 84.8%, and it went down in 2002 to 77%. But 2002 general election was an early election, and early elections traditionally have a lower turnout. So it's very hard to think about the real effects of MMP. And the real expert on this in New Zealand is someone on turnout, is called Jack Vowles. He might have some of his stuff on his website, but he has argued that it might be the case that, you know, everywhere in the world turnout's going down. And he said we can't really tell whether MMP has made it worse or actually stopped a decline that would have been much greater. So it is extremely different to the initial year, of course. Initially, the first one, it went up and everyone thought, wow, fantastic. But one of the things that the Electoral Commission is trying to do as is happening here in Canada, is to get young people out to vote.
Thank you.
Same here. Carrie.
Has there been much confusion to start with the voters in terms of switching to the new system? And have there been many complaints over the 10 years that the new system's been in operation, the new electoral system?
You mean complaints about just learning a new system and the difficulty of the two votes?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. No, I don't recall complaints about the complexity of the system. The Electoral Commission monitors people's knowledge of the system, and we have very good data on what people understand. They understand very well now that they have the two votes and what they're for. They understand very well that the party vote, most people understand, not all, that the party vote is the significant one for determining the overall distribution of seats in the House. They're not so good, their knowledge is not so good on the threshold issues. I'm sorry, I don't think I really answered your question, but...
Ken?
I was wondering about the ballot that you showed. Like, I know those were only vegetables and not parties. But I was wondering, it was alphabetized?
Yes, every ballot paper is alphabetized according to the candidates' names for the constituency vote. So if your name is Alan, your surname is Alan, and you are a National Party supporter, your name would be at the top of the constituency vote, but the party vote, on the party vote side, that would be matched at the same level by the National Party, if that's what you were standing for. That was something that the major parties wanted and the minor parties didn't. That was not the recommended ballot paper of the Royal Commission. But in fact, the impact on the party vote is randomised, because every electorate's going to be in a different order of the party vote, because it depends on the surnames of the constituency candidates.
Did it have any kind of weird effects, for example, people choosing all sorts of people with a last name of A to be their constituents?
No, we have noted none of those effects at all.
Douglas.
Oh boy, do I have questions. But I'll only ask one. With this system that you have, is there a situation where the list candidates are dominating the heads of the ministries, or are the heads of the ministries coming from right across the board in Parliament?
Cabinet selection is whether people are list MPs or constituency MPs has no connection with cabinet selection whatsoever.
Not that there's a connection, but does there seem to be a pattern where more of the ministers are coming off of the list or more of them coming out of the constituency?
I haven't done that kind of analysis. It's an interesting question. But off the top of my...
Or the zombie candidate, that's what we're curious about.
Zombie candidate?
Well, that's a term that was brought up by Campbell, where we have somebody...
It's all your fault, Ken.
Was it Ken? Ken was... you mentioned that the zombie candidate brought up... somebody could be voted out within a constituency but be on the list and be brought back into government. Has that happened in New Zealand?
Yes, it has happened, but not very often. There are two ways of looking at this. You see, if a party has... put someone high on the list because they're senior and the party wants them in cabinet, and that person does not have a safe seat, or is in a marginal seat, it might be quite sensible to put them in a winnable place on the seat and let them lose a constituency. After all, it gives that party a good chance of winning a marginal seat. So there have been cases with high-profile people, effective ministers, who actually have got in on the list seat and fought for the party an unwinnable seat. So it works both ways. Yes, I mean, you can rescue zombies, but you can also rescue people who are jolly good for the country.
Okay, thank you. Probably two more, RB and then David.
Thank you. I'm here. I still haven't found them. Sorry.
Oh, thank you.
In your new system, a party can win more local seats than the total PR entitles it to.
What happens?
Now, it has been said in Germany the party is allowed to keep those seats and the size of the legislature expands. Now, my questions are what is happening in New Zealand and is there any other way to do that?
Thank you. I should have addressed that issue in my presentation and I didn't. Yes. It's exactly the same as in Germany. In other words, if a party wins more constituency seats than it should have in terms of the total share of the party vote, it keeps all those seats and Parliament expands in size, but just until the next election. This hasn't happened in New Zealand, just as well, really, for the legitimacy of the new system, in my view. But it hasn't happened. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have two more. David and then Anne.
Yes, you mentioned that negotiation become usual within the parliamentary committees.
Where is he?
Sorry.
Yes.
That negotiation has become much more accepted within the parliamentary committees. Before the change, was there an effective committee system which has now been improved, or was there an ineffective system that has now been made effective?
They started improving the system really back in the 1970s. Because the Parliament was, well, some members of Parliament were very well aware that without an upper house, you really have to have a very effective committee system because there's no other means of looking critically at government and at legislation. So, and in 1985, under the Labour government, the Parliament completely reformed its committee system and created subject committees with extensive powers and that were specialist subject committees. And so when MMP came, it already had a nucleus of a very powerful system. And when the party dynamics changed, of course, that made the committees more powerful. Thank you.
Concerning the Maori vote, I presume do they vote like from the country as a whole? They're not from separate areas. Do you have any idea what's the percentage who opt to vote in the general vote, and has that changed in subsequent elections?
I can't remember the percentages, but increasing percentage of Maori are choosing to vote in the Maori constituency rather than the general constituency. As for the distribution of Maori, about 90% live in the North Island, about 10% in the South Island, and some areas have more Maori living there than others. Does that answer your question, or would you like to ask me again another one?
I just wondered if you know, people have changed, that they felt that it was better for their future if they change with the Maori vote rather than in the general vote, or the other way around?
Maori go both ways. I mean, some people think, some Maori prefer to vote on the general seats, but it's entirely up to Maori. It's interesting that the number of seats has gone up from 4 to 7, but not overwhelmingly. I mean, if all Maori registered on the Maori register and chose to vote on the Maori constituency seats, then there would be, you know, several more seats. So, okay. Thank you.
Elizabeth, we're very pleased that you were selected amongst your Kiwi political scientists. Thank you very much for joining us. And I think for all of us here, this has been a very interesting discussion of the effects and ramifications of change. I know both Campbell and Ken have talked about this a lot, that we must anticipate what kinds of changes happen when a system does change. So the story was wonderful and beautiful and great in detail. Thank you very much. And we will have a chance, of course, to talk to Elizabeth and David after dinner tonight. We'll see you at 3 o'clock in the discussion groups.
Thank you.
Thank you.